Do we have, are we going to, you have it up here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So spring planning. Have to sit down for a minute. Hence the tall chair. It feels like spring now, even though it started 3 weeks ago. Around March 21st is when spring started. I don't feel like it's spring yet until it's finally warm to stay. And I think we're there. I think the snow is history for one more season. I hope it's true. He says no, but I think it's here. Springtime brings along with it the yearning to plant flower gardens or a vegetable garden, or even clean up the yard. Has anyone cleaned up their yard yet? As you can see, I have. It was kind of warm out there. That's from cleaning up the yard and a track meet. It feels kind of like a new beginning. Maybe it's the most exciting time of the year. Spring, that is. We've just gotten done with the cold and being housebound, and now we can go outside and do something comfortably. I know there are winter things to do outside, but most people just stay inside and try to keep warm. I'm one of those people. If I have to shovel snow, I will, but it's only to shovel the snow. It's not to go out there and play in the snow. Maybe when I was young, but now it's just to keep warm. I want to use that spring, or that idea of spring and how we feel about it, as an allegory or an analogy to church or to our church group specifically, you people right here. So there are things we know, but sometimes we need to be nudged toward or need to be reminded about this subject, the subject I'm going to cover. Things we know, but we don't always have them on the forethought or on the forefront of our whatever part of the brain it is that you use when you think. So when we garden, there's a certain amount of planning and prep to do. I'm sure most of you older people and middle-aged people, whatever a middle-aged person is, I'm not sure, or medium-aged people, you've been involved in that. Putting a garden in, planting a garden, planting a garden, and trying to maintain a garden. We also know that the beginning process is not all that you need to do or all that needs to be done. Cultivating is necessary, or a necessary step of having a successful garden, whatever that is. I have that's the pointer. I'm always confused about the pointer on here. There's a little green line on here that I think is advance, but it's not. It's the pointer. So one day I'll learn. This is, doesn't this make you excited? Look at that. Somebody got their garden clean. It's organized. There's no weeds in it. It's growing well. And it didn't just happen. They had to plant till, plan, purchase, for all that little picture. And then, if we don't cultivate it, it might, in a few weeks or days, seems like days, look like this. Where did the rose go? I know this is a different garden, but you might also call this your weed patch. You might not even call it a garden anymore. You change the name completely and call it a weed patch. Is this what your garden's going to look like? Maybe, maybe not. Well, if we take the time to cultivate and have lots of help, as we see in the picture, then our gardens can continue to look like this all season long and be productive and fruitful. And you might see a weed here and there, but they do pretty good on that one. It's advanced. I'm going to say that this last one is what we're going to call the most successful of gardens. I know that some may argue because people do that now. I'm sure that nowadays somebody would say it's all about my garden identity. It looks like a weedy garden, but it's identifying as a clean garden. I'm not even going to go down that road. I'm just going to say that last one was the most successful garden, but there are people that want to argue any point. So I want to look at our church and the beginning of organized religion. I know they're a long ways apart, the beginning of organized religion and our church. While some of the things might change in religion over time, some things may be outdated, while some other things are not ever going to change that are related to church. There are some things that do change, but there are some things that do not change. That's kind of the point I'm making here. All the way through to the last day, there are things that don't change from the beginning of organized religion all the way through the last day, which was in our songs. When Jesus returns with his kingdom, that's the last day that I'm talking about. One of these constant things is family. That's something that doesn't change all the way through. During the account of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is not our subject today, God said this about Abraham. And I think these words in these verses is the beginning of organized religion. So I wasn't just saying that earlier. I think this is where it begins. It's in, we're going to read this out of ERV. And that's the easy read version in case you didn't know. Genesis 18, 18 and 19. Abraham will become a great and powerful nation, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed because of him. I have made a special agreement with him. I did this so that he would command his children and his descendants to live the way the Lord wanted them to. I did this so that they would live right and be fair. Then I, the Lord, can give him what I promised. So it's the beginning all the way to the last day. But he made a special agreement with him that he would command his children and his descendants to live the way the Lord wanted them to. So it's a challenge for us now, but I think these verses show that the family is the mode that God chose to move forward his message and belief of the promised kingdom. The scriptures tout this all the way back to Genesis 18, right here. And the fact that he made a special agreement with him, then I, the Lord, can give him what I promised, closes out that that thought that I was trying to make there. So the New Testament also brings the church as a family too. This was Abraham, you know their mode of people, Abraham, Isaac, then Jacob. Jacob was the one whose name was changed to Israel, and his children are the ones that are that nation, or the first nation that God chose, or the nation that God chose. But he chose Abraham because he would, if you want to say rule, you can. If you want to say teach, you can. If you want to say command, that's what they used in this translation, they're all the same. He ran his family, he taught his family, he commanded his family to follow the things that God wanted them to know and the things that are important. And it comes through family. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Israel, and down the line or down the lineages. But the New Testament does bring the church as family too, as Abraham started, which really was Jacob, but Abraham was made the promises. But also our bloodline families or our blood families are mentioned too in the New Testament. It talks about the church as being a family, but it also talks about our real families being family. To get my point, I have four verses from the New Testament, and let's just go through them. We'll just go through them one at a time. 1 Timothy 5:8 says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." So that's a verse about family from the New Testament. Here's another one, Colossians 3:20. Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Don't forget the this is well-pleasing to the Lord part. The next one we have is 1 Corinthians 11:3. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man the head of a woman, and God the head of Christ. That's about family as well. Another verse in the New Testament, Matthew 12, it's the words of Jesus. But Jesus answered the one who was telling him and said, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And stretching out his hand towards his disciples, he said, "Behold, my mother and my brothers and my brothers." So he's pushing the title of his mother to the disciples, his mother and his brothers. They're his big family, his more bonded family than even a blood family. "For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." So it even expanded bigger to even a tighter than blood family by including brother, sister, mother, all as how family they are to him. Those that follow Christ are that much family to him. So family is mentioned, and these verses are how we ought to be behaving to please God. Remember, it's in the one, do these things, be children, be obedient, and it will please the Lord or please God. They also point out different responsibilities to different family parts. Parents should be providers. We saw that in one of the verses. Not only for food, but providing spirituality as well, or the spiritual welfare of their children. Children should be obedient. There's another responsibility. And the peck order is given. We have God as first, then Christ, then the man, then the woman. Each one has its master or family head in that order. And again, there are some modern ways of thinking that will, what will I say next? Argue that order. They'll argue that order, saying that everyone is equal. But that's not what the Bible says. That's not what they're teaching in the Bible. The Bible is teaching this is the order of the family. You have God, Jesus, the Father, and the wife, or the husband and the wife. Meanwhile, another aspect of family and church family is now very seldomly taught, and that is about marriage. We have a lot of kids in here that will think about or be thinking about marriage in the next few years. Can you believe it? I didn't want to shock Sarah so much, or Brian and Hannah, or anyone else, Miranda. Next few years, or even Timothy, Veronica, the next few years, you got some kids that are going to be thinking about marriage. They're almost ready to marry. Or are they? Are they almost ready to marry? This is where I think the Church of God, or our churches collectively in history, have at some point missed the boat by not teaching what we should do. I'm not saying that they haven't taught truths. I'm thinking that some truths haven't been emphasized enough. In the Old Testament, the law of Moses contained safeguards to try to keep God's chosen people pure. You can probably think of some of those laws. I have one on the board. It's in Exodus 23, 31 through 33, and this is the law proper as it's written. It says, "I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to," this is part of Moses' law, "from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines," which I think is the Mediterranean Sea, because Gaza is right over there, and that's where the Philistines were. "And from the wilderness to the river Euphrates, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand and will drive them out before you." Remember, they just blew the trumpets? They didn't even have to fight. Well, they did after the walls came down. They blew the trumpets and the wall fell. God will deliver them into their hand. They aren't doing it. God is doing it. "So you shall make no covenant with them or their gods." It says, make no covenant. Marriage is a covenant. So don't take people from those lands, is what what God is saying. They shall not live in your land, because they will make you sin against me, for if they serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So there's a reason. It's a safeguard. It's not just a rule because I want to be a mean guy, God. It's to protect the people that that he has already chosen, to keep them on the path or keep them doing the things that are pleasing to him. So it's recorded much more plainly by the time you get to Joshua, which isn't very much further than Exodus. It's near the end of Joshua's, I'll say, rulership as Joshua, before they go into the judges. In Joshua 23:11-13, it says, and this is Joshua warning the people, so take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God. If you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you, and intermarry with them, so that you associate with them and they with you, know for certainty, or with certainty, that the Lord your God will not continue to drive out these nations from before you, but they will be a snare and a trap to you, and they will whip your sides and have thorns in your eyes until you perish off of this good land which the Lord has given to you. So that's what God was thinking about when these people intermarried with the people. They would be whipping their sides, and it was like having thorns in your eyes. Can you even imagine that? I can't. One time I got one in my foot, though. It was this really long thorn. Or maybe it was my sister. It was my sister. So, you ever remember something that isn't exactly you? You've been over it so many times when you were a kid. My dad had to pull it out. Sorry about the sidetrack. We were in the woods. She got a thorn in her foot. It was like right here. And it was like this long. And it was bleeding out a little bit on the sides, and she would not let me pull it out. The two of us were the only ones together. We were probably a quarter mile from home out in the woods. We went up there to the house through the woods with the thorn in her foot. Oh, there's a thorn in my foot. I can pull it out. No, my dad has to do it. And she would not pull it out until he came home from work and he pulled it out. Then it was all right. Anyway. So Joshua was, I don't know how the thorn in the foot got there, but it was a thorn in the eye. That would really hurt worse than a thorn in the foot. So marriage outside the Jewish faith was not good for the nation. That's what these verses are pretty good on that. Just as marriage outside the church is not good for the church, nor does it please God. Remember, part of the family obedient thing is pleasing God. We can't forget that part, nor does it please God. Here's some New Testament verses, if you aren't satisfied with only having the Old Testament on the subject, which I wouldn't be. I would want New Testament verses on the subject. 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 6:14. Here's what it says about how we're supposed to be. Do not be bound together with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? You can kind of see what's going on in the verse. Or what harmony has Christ with Belial or Satan? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Now that's pretty plain. Unbelievers and believers, they really don't have a big commonality. It's pretty self-explanatory. For more study on that particular subject of marriage proper than 1 Corinthians 7, which we're not going to read in any of, but remember 1 Corinthians 7 because it gives a blow-by-blow on the subject of marriage for believers. I have that in my notes. So you have to determine what a believer is. But it's very specific on what to do, what not to do, when to, when not to, and things like that. So 1 Corinthians 7. So you young people, hey, there's a whole row of them. You young people need to know what that says and take it to heart and make it part of your, do they do mantras now? Part of your mantra. Do you know what that is? It's your saying. or your, I want to say make it part of your core or your core belief. So these are, the scriptures are supposed to be our guidelines. Think about the Church of God in general. I say the Church of God. What would it look like if we were all diligent about staying with the faith, keeping in the church? I think it would be a big different picture, don't you? What does all this have to do with spring and gardening anyway? Remember we were going to do the spring and gardening thing? We even had pictures of a garden. What's it got to do with it? Remember how springtime is a time for planning and prep? Well, now that it's sunburn time, it's time for planning our summers too and prep. So our children, like a garden, need seeds planted in their minds to grow into fruit-bearing individuals. Unless they're cultivated, how can we expect that they will grow spiritual fruit? You saw the weed garden. It's not going to grow anything. So we need to cultivate our children in spirituality and in spiritual matters and spiritual things. It's the responsibility of the parents to lead their kids on that path. But I don't think it stops there. It's the responsibility, or the grandparents and friends and siblings have responsibility as well, to encourage and to help facilitate the growth of our youth. It's a family affair. Even now, it's still about family. God's message, God's promises, and all that stuff. It started as family, it still is family. The Bible tells us that iron sharpens iron, so people can build off of other people and become better people. I'm challenging all of the young people that are here, and even if you're listening only, that are not restricted by certain ages to attend a camp this summer. I know that some of the camps have an age limit that you wouldn't qualify for, but there are camps that everyone qualifies for. So I'm challenging all of the young people to attend. I've already told them this on Wednesday night. They got it out there by the campfire as well. But now everybody knows. So attending camps and retreats help you develop a broader friend base. This is a positive thing. And they also start relationships with like believers, which I think is an important part of pleasing God, staying in the truth. Why wouldn't you try to establish relationships with like believers, for not all of your friends, but your closest friends? It's also a place you could end up with a wife or a husband in those few years. Parents, how can we expect our children to remain in the faith without offering them an audience of like faith people, either for friends or as potential spouses? It seems like it's kind of important to me. To me, it seems like it's kind of important. Camps and retreats can also be an instigator of memorable events. Camps and retreats help cultivate our children's spiritual lives. Does anybody have a memory from a camp? Can you say one? This would be hard, right? Brian, will you share one with us?
I've got lots of memories from camp.
Wait till you get the microphone.
Through some old train tunnels on a bike, on a
Does anybody else have one that they'd like to share? Connie?
I just liked how the recording was. I had not listened to the radio, not watched TV, and the days seem so long. You have a lot of time. Meditate and play with your friends. And it was, like you said, they all were there for the same reason, I think, because their families, it was important to their families to send them to camp. And the campfires were especially meaningful, just singing the songs and seeing the stars.
Yep.
And that's why I like those camp songs that you sing.
Yeah, we did do camp songs. Why am I doing this? I have one already. Do you have one?
Yeah.
You do?
It was Camp Emmaus.
Oh.
In the basement of Camp Emmaus, they had a bunch of cups of puppy jam. I'm pretty sure it was Natalie who had tipped it upside down to try to get the last of the powder out of the cup, and she sneezed it.
And she was covered with puppy chow dust.
Like face, shirt right here.
Thanks, Elijah. Floyd?
I didn't go to camp, but my son Ron, he went to camp out in Washington. And they just had such a great time. He says them were the best days of his life. That's what he's got to say about it.
Yeah, he still talks about it.
Yeah, and he's old now. Anyone else? I went to the same camp that Ron went to when I was a kid. I went to Camp Mack two years, back when it was called Camp Mack. That feels weird. I remember getting girlfriends there. Every time there was a new camp, I got a new girlfriend. That was a long time ago. But then when I was a little bit older, I did that when I was probably 13, 14. I don't know how old you had to be to start going there back then. But from probably 15 on, I went to the Washington State Camp, like Ron did. And I remember we went on a hike one time. It was a week-long camp in the mountains. There was no refrigeration. There was a cold river. That when we first went to camp, we would stack rocks around the river to make a pool so that the food wouldn't float down the river. So that was our refrigerator. And our water was, somebody would run up the mountain and plug a hose into the river. And there was a faucet running down there in the river the whole time. That's where you got all of your water. We went on a hike one time. I think 13 of us went on a hike to the lake that this river came from. It was called Icicle River, and it was cold. When I washed my hair in there one time, I dipped my head in the river on Sunday morning. I put the shampoo in my hair and lathered it all up. I stuck my head back in the river, and it all turned hard, like a bar of soap. And so it took me a lot of dunks to get the soap out of my hair. I only did that one time. But we went on a hike up there, and it got dark. And the group of us, Jim Rankin was in the group at the time. He was leading the hike. And he kind of knew where we needed to go. I don't know how he knew, because it was pitch dark out and not any time flat. And we walked until early in the morning. We got home, back to camp, maybe 3 in the morning, something like that. Once it got dark, it was not easy. We had to hold arms, hold hands. We had to stop and rest. We went on places that if it was daytime, we wouldn't have gone. It was just a really good time. And those memories don't go away. You know, they are kind of what you base your friends around, those kinds of things that happen. I know things can happen at school and places like that that are good times with your friends and that too. But the fact that you're with people of like faith has a different meaning. It has a deeper meaning than just a friend, or more than just a friend, like Jesus described. That people that are his, or people that follow him, are his brother, his sister, and his mother. It's a deeper friendship than you will get from the regular world. So, here's our recap. Remember who is responsible to help and encourage our children. Remember that it is God we are pleasing when we follow his way. And remember always to stay in the church. I'd like to close with song number 219. Shall we stand as we sing this song? 219.